Their commander, a graphic designer named Karlheinz Hoffmann, had often declared that he wanted to, quote, save young people from spiritual and physical neglect, thereby performing a task supported by the Bavarian Constitution, unquote. The authorities, and above all, the Bavarian Interior Minister, happily believed him and treated him benevolently. Hoffmann and his troops, outfitted with military equipment, did not limit their mischief to the woods around Nuremberg, yet they still had nothing to fear. Thanks to his good connections, especially among the police, he regularly learned of impending house searches in advance. Meanwhile, the courts ignored his ties to Belgian, French, Italian, English, and American neo-fascists, instead treating him as a harmless, quote, gun enthusiast, unquote. Nearly all the leading figures of the illegal NSDAP/AO, that's a German Nazi Party Auslandorganisation, passed through Hoffmann's martial sports camp, and his band of thugs raised havoc throughout the entire republic. Nevertheless, only months before the Federal Interior Ministry banned the troop at the end of January 1980, Bavaria's Interior Minister, Gerald Tandler, T-A-N-D-L-E-R, gave the neo-Nazis his approval, finding that, quote, martial sports are not in themselves criminal, unquote. After the ban, Hoffmann transferred his activities to Lebanon with the help of the PLO. In 1981, he was arrested on charges of counterfeiting, intimidation, grievous bodily harm, and for infringement of laws governing on weapons and explosives. For these offenses, in addition to numerous cases of deprivation of liberty, he was finally sentenced in 1986 to 9.5 years behind bars. He was then 48 years old. As a model prisoner, able quickly to adapt to the prison's authoritarian system and entrusted with errands by the thankful wardens, Hoffmann was freed in 1989, despite the fact that he had in no way, quote, altered his beliefs, unquote, as he openly admitted to television reporters. The trial against Hoffmann turned up horrifying details about life in his camp in Bir Hassan in Beirut. That's spelled capital B-I-R, capital H-A-S-S-A-N. There, Hoffmann had established a reign of terror that provides a perfect example of neo-Nazi brutality. Members of his troop were treated with bestial cruelty and tortured with glowing bayonets. Kai Uwe Bergmann, a 20-year-old from Hamburg, did not survive his ordeal. Hoffmann and his deputy camp commander laid a burning coal on his stomach, whipped him, and then beat him with everything they had. The reason? Bergmann had disobeyed Hoffman's no-smoking rule several times. His corpse was never discovered. The punishment handed out to his tormentors was rather less severe. The troopers Franz Joachim Boharski, B-O-J-A-R-S-K-I, Walter Ulrich Bele, B-E-H-L-E, and Uwe Meinka, M-A-I-N-K-A, got off with sentences ranging from 19 months probation to 2 years and 9 months imprisonment. These follow-up trials were hardest on Horst Röhlich, R-O-Umlaut H-L-I-C-H, a printer from Heidelberg, who got 4.5 years. At Hoffman's orders, he had printed not only the camp's, quote, battle paper, unquote, commando, but also $800,000 worth of counterfeit money with which Hoffmann had hoped to finance his terrorist activities. And the murder of Jewish publisher Shlomo Levin, L-E-V-I-N, and companion Frieda Peschke, P-O-E-S-C-H-K-E, in Erlangen on the night of December 19, 1980, these two were shot to death only a few miles from Hoffman's home. A pair of sunglasses belonging to Hoffman's girlfriend was found at the scene of the crime, and the weapon used was one that had already been confiscated from a Hoffman intimate 5 years earlier, only to be returned shortly thereafter. In the view of the state prosecutors, Hoffman had delegated the murder to his close friend Uwe Behrendt, B-E-H-R-E-N-D-T, the motive being, quote, militant radicalism of a fascist nature, unquote. The court, however, decided that Uwe Behrendt had acted as a, quote, solitary perpetrator, unquote. How lucky for Hoffmann that Behrendt had died in Lebanon in the summer of 1981. Suicide, according to Hoffmann. Then, there is the matter of the bombing at the Munich Oktoberfest on September 26, 1980, in which 13 people died and over 200 were injured. Once again, the tracks lead straight to Hoffmann. But none other than Hans Langemann, L-A-N-G-E-M-A-N-N, chief of Bavaria's Verfassungsschutz, gave him an alibi. According to his testimony, Hoffmann was in Neuburg, N-E-U-B-U-R-G, all day under observation by his agency. Hoffmann himself, however, claimed to have spent the entire day in Nuremberg and produced several witnesses to that effect. This would not be the only complication in the investigation. Investigators quickly decided that the attack was, again, the work of a single culprit, and that Gundolf Köhler, K-O-U-N-O-H-L-E-R, who had been fatally injured in the explosion, must have been the perpetrator. To be sure, he was a member of Hoffmann's military group, but his motive was determined to be personal, not political, the result of a fight with his girlfriend. Evidence and testimony suggesting that Köhler hadn't acted alone was quickly dismissed, and his involvement in the neo-Nazi scene was never thoroughly examined. Testimony that directly incriminated Hoffmann was disqualified by the investigators as, quote, alcohol-inspired nonsense, unquote. Experts ruled out the possibility of a single person building, deploying, and detonating such a heavy bomb, but the investigation was nonetheless discontinued in 1982 with the pithy remark, quote, concrete evidence for the participation of another party does not exist, unquote. So note again, Hans Langemann, functioning in a very interesting capacity as head of Bavaria's Verfassungsschutz, apparently assisting, like other elements of the police and military, the sports school, the Sportgruppe Hoffmann, which sounds remarkably similar to the sports school that trained the murderers of Solingen and Bernd Schmidt, a Verfassungsschutz agent. What we're going to look at next is a link of Bernd Schmidt, the aforementioned Verfassungsschutz agent, to another part of Europe in which fascism was resurgent, namely Italy. By the way, we should note in passing that elements of the Sportgruppe Hoffmann have carried on to this day. A prominent element of that organization, Otfried Hepp, became a member of Abu Abbas's organization, and that organization implicated not only in the Achille Laurel hijacking, but Otfried Hepp and Abu Abbas very close to Manzer al-Kassar, who apparently helped to arm the Achille Laurel operation. Manzer al-Kassar also deeply involved with Oliver North and the Contra support effort, using, among other companies, the Merex firm, a West German-based arms firm, founded by Gerhard Mertens, who was a wartime associate of Otto Skorzeny, who assisted Mertens with the Merex firm. Oh, by the way, Mertens was also part of that Galen-Skorzeny Middle East contingent assigned to the Middle East. What we're going to look at next is the connection of Bernd Schmidt to Operation Gladio. That was a contingency program to set up guerrilla groups to harass the Red Army in its rear in the event of an invasion of Western Europe. As we have seen in the past, it appears to have been deeply connected to the Strategy of Tension, a program of fascist terror in Italy. We're going to take a look at Operation Gladio, and then we're going to take a musical break, and we're going to come back and review the Gladio connections to Reinhard Galen, and we're going to swing over to Italy, where once again fascism is on the march. This, again, Germany Alert, Tuesday, June 7th of 1994, an article by Brenda Williams that reads, VS agent Bernd Schmidt. Now, this is the same Bernd Schmidt who was a Verfassungsschutz agent and head of the Solingen, quote, sports school, unquote, where the German neo-Nazis who perpetrated the Solingen bombing were trained and indoctrinated. VS agent Bernd Schmidt had connections to the NATO terror group Gladio and was probably a Gladio operative. Schmidt was trained by Horst Wieland, W-E-I-L-A-N-D, a notorious martial arts expert who has been linked to Gladio international terror. Gladio was a NATO front that used known Hitler Nazis and collaborators to form an, quote, anti-terror, unquote, organization after the end of World War II. After training with Wieland, Schmidt set up his own martial arts training school in Solingen. The mainstream German media knew 1 year ago that Bernd Schmidt was a government agent, but refused to report the fact. State-run ZDF television declined to broadcast the fact after consulting with officials of Verfassungsschutz. Even now, German media reports decline to state that Schmidt was trained by Wieland or is believed to have been a Gladio agent. So it's not established that Schmidt was a Gladio agent. Rather, he was trained by Horst Wieland, who is a documented Gladio agent. So it remains probable but not verified that Bernd Schmidt was a Gladio agent. In any event, it's very interesting because it also illustrates the connecting links between Schmidt and his milieu and the Verfassungsschutz and the Solingen Sports School and Horst Wieland of Gladio infame illustrates the ways in which the Galen organization and its related elements served as a seedbed, and how the seeds of Nuremberg, or the seeds that were planted at Nuremberg, the failure of the denazification, and not just the legal denazification process, but the failure of the entire world to properly analyze and confront the nature of fascism and the forces that created it, the Schmidt-Wieland-Gladio link is indicative of the extent to which those seeds, the seed bed in which they were planted and the shoots that have come up from those seeds, are now threatening to strangle the democracies of the entire world with the weeds that have grown from that situation. What we're going to look at now is some more information from the book The New Reich by Michael Schmidt. We're going to recapitulate a passage we've read before, and this concerns not only Operation Gladio, but its connections to the propaganda Douay Lodge of a former SS officer and Italian fascist Licio Gelli, something we're going to be looking at greater length next week. And we're going to be taking a look at Reinhard Gehlen's godfathership, so to speak, of Operation Gladio. Of Operation Gladio, its connections to German and Italian and American fascism, the author Michael Schmidt writes as follows. In Italy, on October 17, 1990, details of a clandestine NATO group known only by the codename Gladio began to emerge from a probe into right-wing terrorism by Venetian judge Felice Casson and from Italian government inquiries into the Red Brigade's murder of Premier Aldo Moro and the role of the Italian secret services. By the way, judge's name, C-A-S-S-O-N. Giulio Andreotti, then the Italian prime minister, admitted that a secret army of anti-communist guerrillas still existed and had for more than 40 years. Andreotti had served as Italian defense minister from 1959 to 1966 and had been personally involved with underground structures established for the purposes of organizing rearguard resistance in the event of a Warsaw Pact invasion of Western Europe. It turned out that Gladio, with an estimated strength of 1,000 people in Italy, was only the Italian arm of a paramilitary front extending across the whole of Western Europe, including even neutral Sweden and Switzerland. Andreotti's confession detonated a political bomb. Gladio, the Cold War's best-kept secret, was also known to Italian President Francesco Cossiga, who confirmed that he had dealt with the organization in 1967 during his own term as defense minister. However, as recently as August of 1990, Andreotti told the Italian parliament that Gladio had been wound up in 1972, and NATO spokesman at the headquarters in Belgium likewise denied the organization's existence. The mention of Gladio's NATO connections and NATO's adamant, even frantic denials immediately touched off journalistic investigations in other countries that, often with the help of former NATO and CIA insiders, soon revealed why this matter was so delicate. In Italy, for example, it became known that Gladio was also active in internal politics. Roberto Cavallero, C-A-V-A-L-L-E-R-O, a former Gladio member, told the Italian news magazine Panorama that he was trained to prepare groups that, in the event of an advance by left-wing forces, would fill the streets, creating a situation of such tension as to require military intervention. He also claimed that other members of Gladio, working with Italy's secret services, or working with Italy's security services, counterintelligence, had infiltrated the Red Brigades who murdered Aldo Moro, the architect of a 1978 pact between his Christian Democratic Party and the still powerful Italian Communist Party. Cavaliero's statements matched remarks made by Moro in letters written during his captivity, suggesting that the secret services could be implicated in an attempt to destabilize the country. These disclosures also gave rise to a welter of accusations that Gladio counted among its connections the shadowy P2 Masonic Lodge, headed by longtime fascist Licio Gelli. By the way, it's not mentioned here, but Licio Gelli was an honored guest at Ronald Reagan's inauguration and had profound connections to the administrations of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, as well as George Bush. Gelli had meetings organized by the CIA with Alexander Haig, Nixon's chief of staff and later NATO's supreme commander, at the U.S. Embassy in Rome in the early 1970s to discuss the need to restrict the power of the Italian Communist Party. One former NATO official charges that the U.S. spent nearly $100 million on a secret project called Stay Behind, which was designed to prevent a communist takeover at all costs. Cavaliero acknowledged Gladio's links with P2, which had financed rightist terrorists like the NAR, the Nuclei Armati Rivoluzionari, the Armed Revolutionary Cells, whose members bombed the Bologna railway station in September of 1980. Later, members of both P2 and groups close to the NAR admitted that the bombing was designed by Gladio to force the political axis to the right. Thus, Gladio connected Italy's ruling conservative Christian Democrats to some of the country's most violent and lawless fascists. Overseeing the whole operation were SISMI, S-I-S-M-I, the Italian Military Intelligence Organization, SISDE, the Italian Civilian Intelligence Organization, and SIFI, S-I-F-A, the Italian equivalent of the CIA. SISDE, by the way, is S-I-S-D-E, all capitals. Continuing, the eruption of the Gladio scandal had international dimensions. In other countries, authorities began to concede that similar operations had been devised for the same purposes, anti-communist sabotage, but not necessarily using fascists as key personnel or weapons in internal politics. In the Netherlands, Premier Ruud Lubbers acknowledged that a Dutch version of Gladio, for which Gerrit Eight Volsing could conceivably have worked, did indeed exist, and that its size had recently been subject to a review. In Greece, Yanis Varvisiotis, then defense minister, that's Varvisiotis, declared that the CIA had launched a similar network under the codename Sheepskin, but that it had been dismantled in 1988. Similar admissions followed in Portugal, Turkey, and France, where, according to defense minister Jean-Pierre Chevènement, it had, quote, only recently been dissolved. Unquote. Chevènement, by the way, and I'm not sure about the pronunciations on some of these names, Chevenement. Continuing with Schmidt's account. However, it was in Germany, Belgium, and Sweden that investigations of Gladio produced the most significant results and revealed the greatest parallels to the Italian experience. In Germany, for example, it emerged that ex-Nazis, some of them SS members from the post-war Bund Deutscher Jugend, or BDJ, had been the first recruits. A former senior CIA officer with knowledge of the entire NATO operation told Graham Atkinson that the U.S. Office of Policy Coordination, a CIA front, had, quote, incorporated lock, stock, and barrel, the espionage outfit run by Hitler's spy boss, Reinhard Gehlen, unquote. He explained that Gehlen was the spiritual father of, quote, stay behind, unquote, and that West German leader Konrad Adenauer was fully aware of his role. Upon Germany's accession to NATO in May of 1955, Adenauer signed a secret protocol with the U.S. in which the West German authorities agreed to refrain from the active legal pursuit of known right-wing extremists. Quote, what was not so well known, unquote, the official continued, is that other top German politicians were party to the existence of secret resistance plans, including the then German secretary and former high-ranking Nazi, Hans Globke, G-L-O-B-K-E, unquote. In fact, the whole secret operation drew almost all its personnel from former SS and Waffen-SS men during the early post-war years, men who were then trained by the British Secret Intelligence Service, or SIS. Later, the entire operation was absorbed into the West German Intelligence Service, the Bundesnachrichtendienst. At the end of 1990, the independent television program Stern highlighted some of the key plans of the German Gladio, including possible assassination of left-wing politicians in the event of a Soviet invasion. High on the list were two leading social democrats, Herbert Wehner, W-E-H-N-E-R, party chairman of the Bundestag and the next communist whom the Nazis had never forgiven for escaping to the Soviet Union, and the mayor of Bremen, Wilhelm Kaisen, K-A-I-S-E-N. So note again, Gehlen as the spiritual father of Stay Behind and the profound Gehlen connections to Operation Stay Behind and Operation Gladio, the Italian manifestation of that NATO operation. We have looked at the so-called strategy of tension, a program of right-wing bombings and terrorists done in association with the Italian secret services and the P2, which appears to have been a direct outshoot of Operation Gladio. We took a look at that in Radio Free America number 19. We took a look at the entire propaganda duet milieu in Radio Free America 17 through 21, came back to it in numbers 34 in RFA number 34. It's also a miscellaneous archive show about Operation Gladio, if you'd like to check that out. Again, note that the person who trained Bernd Schmidt, the VS agent who trained and indoctrinated the murderers of Solingen, Bernd Schmidt was trained by Horst Wieland, a documented Gladio operative. It remains to be seen whether, as alleged in certain quarters, Bernd Schmidt himself was a Gladio operative. The point being, though, as we take a look at what has sprung from the seed sowed at Nuremberg with the failure of denazification, indeed, beyond that, the failure to even understand what fascism was as a world force, and unfortunately the world has never really taken that into account, the recent observations of the 50th anniversary of D-Day bear a great many serious ironies, because the sacrifices of the service people involved in that, to a large extent, I won't say they went in vain. They were not in vain. They bought time, but that's all they did. They did not destroy fascism. They didn't even defeat it, really. They delayed it. But fascism is coming back. It's coming back in a big way because the powers behind it were not destroyed. The taproots of fascism were not destroyed. They have sprung again, and the weeds are growing all over the world. One of the places they're growing is one of the places that Bill Clinton visited in his commemoration of the sacrifices of American troops in World War II. And again, my comments about fascism coming back and about the wasting of those efforts, not they weren't wasted, but they were not, they were blunted, is in no way to should in no way be interpreted as reflecting on the sacrifices of the Allied troops involved. In the Germany Alert newsletter of Tuesday, June 7th of 1994, we find the following in the briefing section. Clinton's appalling approval of Italy's new government won widespread coverage and open praise in the German media. Not surprising. By giving his stamp of approval to a government which openly includes fascists, Clinton pleased German nationalists while earning the condemnation of government leaders in the Netherlands. Well, as we've looked at in the past, and as we're going to look at, at much, much, much greater length next week, the new right-wing coalition in Italy is headed up, first of all, by Silvio Berlusconi, a former member of the P2 Lodge of Licio Gelli that we just touched on. And beyond that, it involves the fascist party of Gianfranco Fini, an open admirer of Mussolini. There is an article in the San Francisco Examiner of Friday, June 10th of 1994 by Paola Butturini, B-U-T-T-U-R-I-N-I, a special to the Examiner at Stateline Rome, headlined, Ghosts of Fascism Haunt New Italy, subheaded, Right-Wingers' Recent Remarks Force Prime Minister to Do Damage Control. This is actually an incorrect title. It's not the ghosts of fascism that haunt New Italy. It is fascism. These are no ghosts. These are real. Skipping down in the article, we find the following. But Berlusconi apparently lost all patience when Fini gave another interview last week while President Clinton was paying tribute to American soldiers who died on the beaches of Anzio and Nettuno fighting Nazi and fascist troops 50 years ago during the D-Day commemorations. Fini said that until, quote, 1 minute before Mussolini signed Italy's racial laws in 1938, unquote, at Hitler's behest, it would have been very difficult to judge fascism in a totally negative light, unquote. Well, that's his opinion, and unfortunately, Gianfranco Fini is no ghost. He is very, very real. And I would note that the sorts of statements that are being made by members of the Italian Fascist Party, which is a key part of this coalition, itself headed up by former P2 member Berlusconi, and the notion of a former P2 member is kind of like the notion of a former SS officer. You never really leave that organization. The forces manifesting themselves in Italy are not ghosts, but might ultimately wind up producing a lot of ghosts, was indicated in an article that was carried in, among other papers, the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, May 30th of 1994. This is a Reuters story, Dateline Rome, and headlined, Italian Fascist Would Incarcerate Gays, subheaded, Outrage Over Concentration Camp Comment. In another embarrassment to Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, an Italian neo-fascist candidate for the European Parliament said yesterday that gay people should be put in concentration camps, a statement that prompted an outpouring of outrage. The comments by Piero Buscaroli, B-U-S-C-A-R-O-L-I, whose party, the Neo-Fascist National Alliance, has five ministers in Berlusconi's cabinet, were reported by the newspaper Corriere della Sera. Proclaiming himself, quote, more Catholic than the Pope, unquote, Buscaroli reiterated his views in an interview with Reuters in which he said homosexuals have no place in society and should be called, quote, fairies and queens, unquote, rather than gays. Quote, they lead terrible lives, unquote, said the 63-year-old Buscaroli in the telephone interview from his home in Bologna. Quote, if it were up to me, I'd send them all to live in concentration camps, unquote. Buscaroli, a journalist who contributes to the Berlusconi family-owned newspaper Il Giornale, is a member of the neo-fascist Italian social movement, which is the core party in the National Alliance and whose members are the political heirs of dictator Benito Mussolini. Well, as we looked at in a miscellaneous archive show called The Pink Triangle, gays, and there was a very prominent gay liberation movement in Weimar Germany, were among the earliest and most rigorously persecuted of the targets of the Nazis and fascists. Because of the traditional social prejudice against homosexuality, gays were a very easy element to isolate and attack, and they were among the very first targets of the Nazis and fascists. Of course, the gays were forced to wear pink triangles and were liquidated by the thousands in concentration camps. Indeed, the Nazis used the issue of gay rights to tar their political opponents with the onus of homosexuality in a manner not unlike the way the Republican Party of the United States is using gay rights to tar the Democrats who are supposedly not supporting, quote, family values, a buzzword if ever there was one. Note, however, this kind of talk, note the willingness to come out and say that that gays should be put in concentration camps. Remarks like this might appear to be inconsequential under the circumstances, but what they are doing is introducing the concept into the prevailing political dialogue, and that is very, very dangerous. What's also worth noting is that for every fascist deputy who's going to come out and say something like that, there are a great many people who will sympathize with this sort of viewpoint. And indeed, the fascist elements that are holding sway in Italy, that were evident in a big way in the propaganda Douay Lodge, very strongly connected to NATO and the United States, by the way, those elements are not ghosts. On the contrary, those are not the ghosts of fascism haunting Italy. That is fascism that's haunting Italy. Although, as I said, if people like Mr. Buscaroli get their way, there will be a lot of ghosts in Italy, starting with the ghosts of an awful lot of gay people, apparently. There was a very important and, to me, very interesting op-ed column that appeared in the New York Times of May 14th of 1994, talking about the successors of Benito Mussolini, and indeed the fascists are now part of the governing coalition of Italy. This article is by Victoria De Grazia, and Victoria De Grazia is a professor of history at Columbia, as identified here again, from the New York Times of 5/14/94. That last article, by the way, from the San Francisco Chronicle of 5/30/94. This is subtitled, Debunk the Myths About Mussolini. The article reads, the coalition government that took power this week in Italy is the first in Western Europe since 1945 to include neo-fascist ministers. If this were Germany, there would be fear. But Italy enjoys the reputation of being humane. The neo-fascists perpetuate the myth by exploiting two durable myths, that fascism was not anti-Semitic, and that Mussolini was a modernizer who made the trains run on time. This manipulation of history should add to worries about the ambitions of the three parties that make up the coalition, the neo-fascist National Alliance, the separatist Northern League, and Forza Italia, headed by Silvio Berlusconi, the political neophyte who is the new prime minister. Though disgust with the corrupt old political class enabled the alliance to win 510 seats in parliament, its claim that it can restore clean government is as dubious as the propaganda that Mussolini did the same thing. That Il Duce's state was not anti-Semitic is sophistry. His apologists say that unlike Hitler, he had no personal antipathy to the Jews, that he even had a Jewish mistress. How, they ask, could fascism have been anti-Semitic if so many Italian Jews joined the fascist movement? The apologists concede that the regime passed laws that persecuted Italians of the Jewish, quote, race, unquote, but they say that was only to ingratiate itself with Hitler after the democracies had unfairly ostracized Italy for wanting a bit of Africa for itself. In any case, they say, the laws were not rigorously applied, and Mussolini himself approved many exceptions. Their ultimate proof of fascist benevolence is that so many Italian Jews survived Hitler's genocide. In fact, the racial laws of 1938, modeled on Germany's 1935 Nuremberg laws, forbade intermarriage between Italians and Jews, banned, quote, Aryan, unquote, servants from working in Jewish homes, removed Jews from influential positions in government, education, and banking, and placed restrictions on Jews' property rights. Government propagandists and fascist party organizations needed little prompting to pump out anti-Jewish scurrility. If fascism was lax about enforcing the laws, it was because Italian-style despotism thrived on the corruption involved in making exceptions and dispensing favors. When the Jews escaped dragnets in Nazi-occupied Italy, it was not because of the party's leniency, but because of the Italian army's non-cooperation, the humanitarian impulses of the people, and the sanctuary granted by the Roman Catholic Church.